Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector, an independent financial advisor, or institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uister. In this episode of our bi-monthly Long Game series, we're joined again by economist, investment strategist, and GIPS professor Adrian Saville, to unpack the bold but evidence-based plan for transforming South Africa's economy. His approach is rooted in a six-factor model developed at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, where he also heads the Center for African Management and Markets. This framework is based on six decades of data from 160 countries, a global study of what actually works to move economies from stagnation to sustained growth. Welcome back to the show, Adrian.
Great to be with you, Ron. And what a lovely talking point, you know, to figure out what South Africa needs.
Absolutely. Adrian, South Africa faces sluggish growth, stubborn unemployment, and the lingering effects of state capture. But your research shows we can turn this around and quite quickly if we focus on the right priorities. You've analyzed the global political reset following the 2024 elections, and you've stressed that in a disruptive world, small open economies like ours need a clear evidence-based roadmap. So my question is, how does this global political reset shape the opportunities and risks for that matter for a small open economy like South Africa?
Ruan, in your question is a couple of elements that I'd like to draw out. The first is your emphasis of the six ingredients. And to walk through those very quickly, there's a basket of domestic ingredients, savings and investment, demography, babies, education, healthcare, and your policies and institutions. Those are what I would call the domestic ingredients. In other words, five of the six are domestic. Get your house in order first if you want to participate in a full, functional, transformative way. But for South Africa to truly thrive, not just prosper, but to absolutely, you know, flourish and thrive, you've made reference to the economy being small and open. And so there's a big story in that, that South Africa needs to participate in a global economy that is changing shape. Now, how does South Africa do that? Well, through the course of the last couple of years, the BRICS plus economies overtook the G7. That changes economic landscape. Along with that, we've got shifts in political landscape. Last year, more people went to the polls than any year in history as a percentage of global population. And remarkably, in two-thirds of those elections, there was a change in political party. So you've got a global landscape that is not only politically transforming, but also economically transforming. And that then brings the question, how does South Africa participate in that? Which makes a foreign policy imperative the go-to. But there's a big however. I've just been involved in a really rich conference presentation and conversation where a similar question was proposed. What does South Africa need to do to get its house in order? And here's the big drum roll, that when we look at those six factors, every single country in our study, 160 countries, 60 years of data, every single country that has achieved elevated, inclusive, transformative growth has a high savings and investment rate, 25% of GDP and more. Now, the message here for South Africa is very, very simple, that if you've got a 15% savings and investment rate, then any talk about fast, elevated, inclusive growth, about redressing unemployment, about addressing inequality, all of that is exactly that. It is just talk. So the call to domestic action is about transforming financial services, financial inclusion, financial literacy, building products that are fit for purpose, for the South African purpose, and then at the same time, establishing an economy that is politically able to face, you know, if I could sweepingly say, East and West.
Adrian, your six-factor model covers, as you said, savings and investment, openness, demographics, policies and institution, education and healthcare. But in your research, you said that not all factors carry equal weight and that our biggest hole is savings and investment. Can you walk us through how you arrived at these six factors and how they are weighed and why savings and investment specifically stand out as the single most important driver of transformation?
So to arrive at these six factors, Ron, I mean, you know, that's a great question. First, the temptation always is to sort of use your assumptions, your beliefs, your biases, and to then, you know, lead the witness. But when we first started this work 15 years ago, it's terrifying how quickly time skips by. We dropped all assumptions at the door, and we've got access to 1,200 data points, and we led the witness in this way. We said a transformed economy has these components. It goes from being a low income per person to a high income per person. It is necessarily inclusive. In other words, unemployment is low, inequality is low, and it is socially prosperous. It has long life expectancy. It has high levels of self-reported happiness. And yes, believe it or not, this can be measured. It gives statisticians enough runway and they can get up to magnificent things. So we've got this extraordinary pool of 1,200 different line items. And we ask our big data, what are the ingredients that are common? And then using just, you know, relatively simple but robust statistical techniques, regression analysis, multivariable regression, we identify these six ingredients that not just over the initial time period, but have continued to consistently explain. So, you know, to emphasize, we published this work first in 2010, and we've updated the work every single year from then to now, and 15 years on, these six ingredients remain resident. But there's two caveats. The first is they don't carry equal weights. Some ingredients matter more than others. And of our six factors, very often, you know, in a conversation with people in emerging markets, we ask, what do you think matters most? And the temptation is to say, you know, it's education. If you can get education right, everything else is solved. Well, interestingly, we find education is actually a lagging indicator, that education follows development rather than leads development. And that healthcare is a coincident indicator. So if you're going to focus on your social elements, you want to worry most about healthcare, then education. And that's a very powerful social cocktail, but you can't educate sick people, would be sort of the throwaway way of putting it. But using regression analysis, and back to your question, we can weight each of these ingredients. And the two highest weights go to savings and investment, and all the way back to your early observation, a small open economy, economic openness or economic connectedness. Those two things are absolutely essential. So South Africa, in order to participate in this changed world, has to get two things right. The first is to, urgently feels like a misplaced word here, but the more we say it and we don't do it, the more urgent it becomes. We have to square up to the story of low savings and investment. And that's about the financial inclusion, the literacy, the products, business confidence. It's also about habits and customs and behavior. And then the second is about the economic openness or connectedness to others. Now, in that connectedness, that ingredient that carries the second largest weight, what's interesting in the last 10 or 15 years is that connectedness has a couple of shapes or forms, including the movement of goods, services, ideas, people across borders, what Pankaj Ghemawat, the international business strategist, calls TCIP, trade, capital, information, and people. And for a long sweep of time, the movement of goods, in other words, international trade, and the movement of capital foreign direct investment, foreign portfolio investment, were the big lifters in terms of global connectedness. More recently, they have been displaced by the movement of I, in other words, information, know-how, know-why, ideas, data. And what's particularly remarkable about this is it's the movement of data that truly democratizes, it flattens the world and allows us to build platform businesses that can be scaled at speed and can be built from almost anywhere. So here there might be three really big messages for businesses thinking about how do we build, you know, fit for that future purpose.
Adrian, in your research, you point to labor-absorbing sectors like agriculture and tourism, with their relatively low barriers to entry and strong job multipliers as key starting points. But beyond agriculture and tourism, which other sectors could realistically deliver large-scale labor-absorbing growth in South Africa over the next decade?
In terms of labor-absorbing sectors or industries, Ron, I think the obvious go-to here is to think about sectors that South Africa has a natural competitive advantage or an historical advantage. There is a second point to add to this, and I think our earlier conversation leads quite neatly to this, because if it is in the TCIP model, if it is I that is going across borders, know-how, know-why, data, information, then that points quite obviously to South Africa presenting itself as a services cluster to the world. So agriculture, tourism, you know, these are obvious go-tos. In terms of tourism, you know, for every 10 tourists that South Africa gets, you get one permanent job. Agriculture, Joe Studwell has done fantastic work on the transformative economies in Southeast Asia, where every one of them that transformed, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, were agriculturally led. But we leave that for another time. What does South Africa have that would fit your question? Financial services is an obvious case in point. And let's look no further than Tyme Bank, South African built. This is now the fastest growing digital bank in the world, where South Africa onboarded 11 million customers in 6 years in South Africa, moved to the Philippines 3 years back, and in that time, they have onboarded 6 million customers. And at the start of this year, have opened up in Indonesia. So here you've got a South African-built, South African-born business that is the fastest-growing digital bank in the world. What else? You know, business process outsourcing. The world loves South African accents. They travel very well, particularly in Europe. We're in the same time zone. Consulting. When you look beyond consulting, you know, to adjacent industries like auditing, you go to the big audit practices around the world, and it is very common to find South Africans resident in North American, European, and Asian audit practices. That can be run from here at a fraction of the cost. So we build in, you know, all of these exportable, transportable services that go across borders at scale and can be built on platform. And there could be a really, really big story. I shouldn't say could be. That's hypothetical. There is a really big story in that for South Africa. It's about the business models.
I read somewhere recently that Afrikaans is considered one of the most sexiest accents out there. So maybe that can be part of the sales pitch.
We'll throw that in, Ron.
Well, Adrian, back to serious stuff. We score well on demographics and a fairly well open economy. But education and healthcare remain deeply unequal. And you argue in your research that building a strong savings and investment base first will create the resources to address these social factors more effectively. But on policies and institutions, your verdict is blunt. Great policy frameworks, yes, but weak implementation. Given the gap between policy design and implementation, where do you see the most immediate wins for strengthening South Africa's institutions?
I think it sits in public-private partnership. That what we have is we've got fantastic policy, and historically we have very capable institutions. You know, we don't need to go into the history of the hollowing out in recent times, but you know, some institutions were rocked back. and others were absolutely, you know, had the rug pulled out from underneath them. Thankfully, South Africa is in the business of repair, and our institutions today are stronger than a year ago and 2 years ago and 5 years ago. So repair is underway. It might be frustratingly slow in places, but what's buried beneath the surface in the six-factor work is that every single country that has transitioned and transformed has done this with public and private. It's not that the public sector did it and the private sector participated, or where the public sector failed, the private sector, you know, stepped in and got on with it. In every instance, it has been about a collaborative and cohesive public-private approach. And I think there is the big message for South Africa, to get out of the industry of pointing, blaming, waiting, but to get into full participation, public-private participation, public-private partnership. That's the triple P. And we're seeing that in places. You know, Eskom has been able to repair at far quicker pace because of the collaboration. We're seeing similar things going on with Michelle Phillips at Transnet, with Transnet now opening itself to this collaboration and participation. So I think, you know, that's the big message, to go to participation and to recognize that participation, for it to be truly functional, it has to be inclusive. In other words, this cannot be a variation on an historical structure where some get to benefit and most are locked out. So the models that I'm talking about, you know, platform, scalable, transformative, are not just about private sector business models. They are business models that actually pick up and transport into the institutional fabric of a country. And if I could give you an example, look no further than Bolsa Família in Brazil, where you've got under President Lula, this was the social welfare program adopted in Brazil that over the next 10 years, 2005 to 2015, resulted in the largest improvement in income inequality anywhere in the world. And it was their social welfare program that drove this redress.
Adrian, despite our challenges, you remain optimistic, and you've called on financial services to step up, from financial literacy initiatives to inclusive savings products. But if you could set just three practical actions for the financial services industry to take into the next 12 months, what would that be?
So I think the first would be about your financial literacy, financial inclusion, to build products that you know, are truly fit for the purpose of an economy that is characterized by very high levels of unemployment, very low levels of financial literacy, and financial exclusion. You know, saying that someone has a financial product doesn't mean that they're financially included. Do they have access to credit? Do they have access to investment products? What type of credit? You know, does the credit feed consumption, or does it feed productive assets? So I think, you know, there's a place for soul searching here in an industry that is globally impressive, you know, is to ask, are we building the best possible things? That would be the one call. The second would be about the public-private that, you know, I've spoken about, and that you have to build in collaboration with, that it can't be the private sector building in the hope that the public sector comes along. But, you know, here I think we really have to square up to the national problem of this low savings and investment rate. And here, to get out of our heads that the things that stop us saving are low incomes and high tax rates. Every single country that built a high savings rate started poor. And in studies on saving behavior, changes in tax rates have no impact on saving. Changes in income have no impact on saving. It is the savings culture or habit that causes saving. So to try and build that imperative. And then a third, I'll be grand. I'll be bold in this. And I'll say to make, I'm not going to call on the private sector. I'm going to call on the private and public sector to make saving a compulsory national imperative. Even if we start with 1% of income and you cannot touch it forever and ever, that we sought to establish and entrench this national savings culture. It is out of that that we will build investment, and it is investment that will drive transformative, inclusive growth.
Adrian, looking ahead, if South Africa were to implement your top priorities starting tomorrow, and in context of what's going on in the world geopolitics and Trump's tariff tirade, how different could the economy, the South African economy, look in 5 years' time?
5 years is quite a short runway, Ron, and I don't want to dismiss your what could happen in 5 years. But the flywheel, even with fast economic growth, takes a little while for it to really start evidencing itself. But 5 years of 5% economic growth, you would start to see an economy where unemployment could easily be, we could talk about a halving of unemployment in the space of 5 years to move us from early 30% to perhaps the mid-teens. You would see improvements in per-person income. Of course, with that unemployment improving, the redress would then start to translate into improvements in equality. But the real thing is to allow these 5 years to rinse and repeat. And I want to give you this by not answering your question. If South Africa, from 1994 to now, in other words, 30 years, if South Africa had delivered on what we had written in every one of our policy documents in terms of economic growth objectives, 5% or so per annum from 1994 to now. And those policies are in black and white. They're called GEAR, ASGISA, NGP, NDP, etc. If we had achieved that economic growth, South Africa would have moved from $6,000 per person in 1994 to $30,000 per person today. In other words, in the space of the 30 years that we're talking about, South Africa would have transformed to be South Korea. That's the power of this narrative.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Adrian, for joining us on the show and helping me to explore how evidence-based policy priorities could fast-track South Africa's move from stagnation to a sustainable and prosperous economy. We will speak to you again in the months ahead for another long game discussion. To all our CityWise South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets Masterminds with me, editor Ruan Uster, and my producer Joe Lowe from the CityWise Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iono.fm. All CityWise South African podcasts and videos are also available on our website, so please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.